In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. Green Day released their latest album, Saviors, on January the 19th, and here in the Underground Garage, we celebrated with a Green Day Week, capping off our celebrations with a chat with Billy Joe Armstrong. Before we listen to our talk, we'll hear a portion of our recent coolest song of the world, Coma City, off of Saviors, and then I'll be back with Billy Joe for your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stevens Underground Garage. Manfred, and we've got such a real treat for y'all today on our coolest conversations because we're capping off our Green Day week in the Underground Garage with a chat with the band's Billy Joe Armstrong, whose various roles include singer, songwriter, musician, record producer, and actor. How are you, Billy?
Good. How are you doing?
Excellent, and I hope you have been enjoying Green Day week here in the Underground Garage. You know, we're celebrating the release of the new album, Saviors.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't go better. It's like my favorite radio station. Pretty wild week for us.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much, man. Did you say favorite radio station?
I did say that, yes.
Oh, well, I just wanted to hear you say that. That's cool.
Confirmed.
All right. Well, man, it's been like 30 years since Dookie, 20 years since American Idiot, both those albums produced by Rob Cavallo. I know he also worked with you guys like on Nimrod and Insomniac. What's the circle? Why bring Rob back again?
I think we just missed him. You know, I mean, Rob, we stayed friends throughout the whole time and when we weren't working together. And, you know, I called him up and just asked him, I was just calling to say hi. And then, I think I texted him, actually. And then he just wrote back, he goes, "Do you want to make rock and roll history again?" Which made me laugh, you know. So, you know, I didn't quite answer that question, but I think, like, I was like, this, you know, the way the songs were shaping up, I thought Rob was like the perfect person to come in and produce.
Well, yeah. Well, can you remind us how you began working with him? What brought you to him to begin with?
Well, we, years ago in 93, it's interesting because he was in our A&R, we signed to Reprise Records, and he was our A&R guy and our producer, which is actually an old school way of doing things, I guess back in the 60s and in the 50s. And, you know, he did the Muffs, the first Muffs record, which we loved and thought it sounded great. And so, you know, we started talking about anything from like late 70s punk rock to the Beatles and how we kind of wanted things to sound. And we were all on the same page real fast. And he was great at getting great sounds and pushing to get good performances out of us. And he just became sort of a kindred spirit for me and someone that I could bounce ideas off of. And he was, just great to work with. And I think we've always had that chemistry ever since.
Well, I like that he responded to your text with, you want to make rock and roll history again. So what is different about working with him now as opposed to when you first started? Like, right, there's got to be a different dynamic there somewhat.
I think, we've grown up, that's for sure. But there's a part of Rob that will never grow up. He's like this eternally high energy 15-year-old that's sort of what he brings into making a record with him, and which is great for me because then, with all the hats that I have to wear, it's like I can kind of go a little bit more into autopilot while he, tells crazy stories about whether it's like he's telling crazy stories about like working with Mo Austin and Lenny Warnker to like, getting a great guitar take and stuff like that, which is, it's just like it's mixing everything up in like good conversation and making the record. So it's, which is really fun because he's just always filled with like high energy and great stories. So it's great.
What I loved you just brought up about Rob was his storytelling, and that's an often overlooked important part of the puzzle there, going to the studio to a working relationship with somebody, because that, you want to hear the stories, you want to, that sets you at ease. It also, it just communicates a lot about the person's personality.
Yeah, it is important to be able to have, like, just be able to kind of step outside of, like, the work that you're doing and just become about like friendship and just that having a connection and just being able to laugh while you're doing it. Just, it makes things more fun. And I think it really adds to what's going on in the record too. So it's pretty great.
So you mentioned when you were, he texted your back and you were thinking about, it sounded like you already had some of the songs pretty much together, and you were thinking, oh, well, he could work really well with these songs, or when actually did the songs come together? Are there any holdovers from the pandemic or more recent efforts?
God, where should I start from? Yeah, there was like the pandemic is sort of when I think the process kind of started. Although like The American Dream Is Killing Me was written during the last record, but we just thought it was like, we weren't really being political on that record. We wanted to. So this time we were, it's like it fit perfectly being more topical. And then I rewrote the lyrics, but I didn't really, I just kind of had that in my sort of holster. I didn't really bring it out yet, but we went to England to record. We just wanted to get out of the United States. And this is in 2021. And so we had a few songs that we had already done. Yeah. And then we had some demos also. And then that's when I reached out to Rob. And then we got together at our rehearsal space, and he listened to those songs that we had rough mixes for. He really loved them. And then I had a song, Bobby Socks, and I had The American Dream Is Killing Me. And then he was just floored by it. And so that's when we picked up and got back in the studio, went back to England with Rob again, and re-recorded a couple of things. And it was great. Like, we would come back home and then do some touring, and then we go back to England again and go to Rack Studios and record more. And then we recorded the last couple songs, "American Dream Is Killing Me" and "Father to a Son." Were the last couple songs that we recorded at Ocean Way in Los Angeles.
All right. So those you did here. Yeah. You know, we've been playing tracks off the new album all week, but our coolest song of the world is Coma City. Any specific zip code from where we can find Coma City?
Well, I'm Oakland based, but I would think about that song as being, sort of a product of the pandemic and everything that was going on in like all of the big cities around the country. you know, it was like desolate, but really volatile at the same time. And like how it felt like, you know, like there was just a lot of rioting going on, and it seemed like it was felt like anarchy. There was no cops. There was no, you know, the everything like busting into Rite Aid and, you know, smashing cars in the streets and setting them ablaze was just, and so I just, that's where, you know, it's like not to get too heavy about it, but that's where the song sort of in my mind of like what I was picturing when I was writing the lyrics for it.
Right. Wow. Okay. Well, I was wondering, was there a specific like news reports, there's a specific tipping point, or was it just sort of general sort of feeling that was coming on that did inspire it?
Well, I think that there was such like this divide in the country, whether it was about like the anti-maskers and the maskers. And then there was, you know, there's one line and there says bankrupt the planet for assholes in space. And it's, you know, it's like, well, you had the big three that were shooting, you know, wanted to
right.
be, you know, astronauts. And while like there was, you know, people starving in the streets and there was things like George Floyd, there's just this big disconnect that was happening between sort of the, you know, the mega billionaires and then sort of the people that lived being houseless or, you know, choosing, you know, having to make hard choices about like, you know, whether they're going to keep their phone bill on or keep the electricity on in their houses. So, and then, you know, obviously after George Floyd and, you know, the beginning of the pandemic felt like really everybody was sort of in it together.
Right.
And then I think like, you know, as time went on, it just felt like one after the other, things were just getting worse, worse and worse and worse. So it was, hence my uncomfortable laughter right now, but it was, yeah, it was just an intense time. And that's where sort of the song, I was just trying to be really thoughtful about it without, like, yeah. I wasn't really trying to, you know, throw darts at people necessarily. It was just more like trying to be observant and not having an opinion so much of just, but more like sort of like reporting what I see and putting it into the song.
You know, a recent single from the album is Dilemma. You guys made a video for it at Alex's Bar in Long Beach. Mm. Have you ever played a gig proper there?
We played there as the Foxborough Hot Tubs.
Okay.
Like, you know, probably about 15 years ago. And it's such a fun bar. And Alex is really cool. I would run into him surfing because he surfs and I surf. So I would just run into him all the time. So he was, you know, and I remember he was really like stressing about like, you know, his club during the pandemic and things like that. And he was one of the people that were, you know, has such an awesome club that like he was able to survive. And then, yeah, so we just asked him if we shoot a video there and he was totally into it.
Well, the first time I had met, Alex was, back in the early 90s, and this was before he had the bar, but he was a promoter putting on shows, and he would put on shows at the Foothills. I think Foothills or Foothill there in Long Beach. It was like a long time country music club, and the lady was, you know, pretty, there was still a family-owned thing, but the lady was pretty ancient then, and, you know, they didn't have sort of the audience space to book really country artists anymore, and so he would put rock shows in there. Did you, in the early days of touring, did you ever play Foothill there in Long Beach?
No, I don't think so. I think we, you know, we would always play, you know, some kind of, you know, all ages thing that would be in like someone's warehouse or backyard party or something like that. But no, never played that place.
And so you found, came across Alex just from surfing?
I know before that we, you know, I knew about the club and, you know, okay. And seeing all the shows that he was putting on there. I mean, it was already kind of becoming infamous, you know?
Yeah. Well, the track Dilemma. So the quote I found online from you about it says, this is one of those songs that was kind of easy to write because it was so personal to me. We've seen so many of our peers struggle with addiction and mental illness. The song is about all the pain that comes from those experiences. So you mentioned peers and their struggles, but you've had your own struggles with this kind of stuff. How's that going for you?
I mean, currently I'm feeling pretty good, but I think I went quite some time, like 5 years where I wasn't like drinking, or partying at all. And then I was just like, ah, screw it. You know, I'm going to, you know, I think it was like right around the Long Shot tour. I started drinking again, and then it was fine for a while. And then all of a sudden it just started to, really take effect on my health and my happiness. And so, you know, I mean, talking to, you know, even like my doctor was like, hey, you know, your liver isn't looking so hot right now. So I was like, well, that's a good excuse for me right there. Yeah. I didn't really do anything like go through any sort of programs or rehab or anything like that. It was just a personal choice that I was just, you know, I have a lot of great friends that are sober and that like to go out and have a good time and, have a Heineken Zero and, you know, go see some good music and split, you know. So it's, that part's been really cool. Like to have, like, I don't think I had like as many friends, like the first time I got sober or sober friends, where now, there's a lot more of my friends that are like, you know, like being, you know, like to go out, like to, be sober and still have a good time and wake up, you know, without a hangover.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, one of the last tunes you recorded for the album, Father to His Son, for Saviors, but quite poignant tune. What was your relationship with your own dad like?
You know, I didn't really have one because he, you know, he passed away when I was about 10. So I never had like I have memories, but that's about it. And so I kind of just go on other people's memories to sort of, you know, that I'll ask about, or they'll tell me stories about that all, you know, kind of fits the legend, you know. But I mean, mostly that song is about me being a father to sons. So it's, you know, where like Wake Me Up When September Ends was like about my father. This is about me being a father. So it's sort of a weird, not really going full circle, but just having just like a big, you know, like just continuing forward and trying to have, you know, deep relationships and things like that.
And they're like in their 20s, mid, late 20s.
Yeah. My oldest is, he's going to be 29. And my youngest is 25.
All right. Well, I have a daughter. She's 22. And there'll be moments where, she's just incredibly insightful. And I think, wow, you know, this is an adult. And then, 15 minutes or 15 seconds later, the toggle switch will go in this other position. And it's just back to, you know, like she's 15. So yeah. I'm imagining, the fellas there farther into the 20s, not as many teenage relapses.
No, nothing like that. They, Adrian, my wife has been, it's just like, she's really like steered the ship as far as like their, you know, being like caregiving and things like that. And I've sort of, you know, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So I was just kind of riding shotgun and kind of, you know, she was sort of listening to her, and she just was like such a natural at it. And for me, I was just like, you know, based on my experiences growing up, is a lot different from theirs. There's some things that are the same, whether it's like Little League baseball and, you know, sharing music together and stuff like that. And I had a lot of great connections with them through that. But you know, as you know, like as far as what the one to wake up the earliest in the morning, I definitely wasn't that person. Yeah.
Hey, another tune on the new album, Corvette Summer. What is it about Corvette that had you paired with Summer?
Well, the song was, it's kind of like, I heard that song by Lou Reed, Rock and Roll Heart. And I just, it was just so, so cool how he was able just to write this song that was about like being, gosh, just like, I just want to hear some, you know, I've just got, it just kind of embodies like what it is to be a rock and roller. And it's very simple, but it's also like something that like you're sort of devote your life to, you know? So it's big, big part of you, big part of me. And it's something, so that's sort of what I that influenced Corvette Summer, is just sort of, I just want to like something, I just want to go to the record store. I just want to kind of have like this, like sit in the sunshine for a minute and listen to music, you know. And this, the name of the song, you know, well, the song is very power pop and has sort of a Bad Finger kind of influence to it, you know, but it's also like, so there's, God, it was Luke Skywalker, who was in the movie Corvette Summer back in the 70s. And that's where I got the title from.
My brother has got a Corvette, and the vanity, he's like maybe 2 years older. You're like, what, 52-ish?
51.
51, okay. So my brother is like 2.5 years older probably than you. But he's got a Corvette, and he has a vanity plate that reads 70s man. That would be Maurice. So I'm Manfred, and he's Maurice.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. So have you ever had a Corvette?
No, I've never had one. I don't think it's really my kind of car, actually. It's just kind of like, it's sort of like a Trans Am, you know, or something like that. Just something I never really thought to. I'm like, this is like the song, this thing is too long for me.
Well, I have to say, I might have just an old, a beater, like a Honda Civic. I don't think I've ever had a car from the decade that I own, that I live in, you know, if I never owned a car from the decade that I'm living in. But anyway, do you have any sports cars? Is that like a...
No. I you know, right now I have a 1970 Chevy Caprice, and man, it's so cool. It just looks like it's straight out of Goodfellas, you know, and it's, you know, it's just a big tank that you, and it rolls around. It's like a, you know, it's like having a Cadillac, but it's not a Cadillac. It's, you know, Chevy, you know, it's like a Monte Carlo or something. Like Chevy Caprice.
That's from a time when they built automobiles, not just cars, but like real proper automobiles. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Totally.
So as I mentioned, we're celebrating the new album's release, Saviors, with a Green Day week here in the Underground Garage. But you guys have got a Green Day channel happening on Sirius XM. It's like Channel 107. Congratulations on that.
Thanks. Yeah, we're really stoked on that.
Yeah. Well, what in addition to Green Day can somebody hear on the Green Day channel?
Gosh, you can hear kind of a lot. Like we, you know, the music that we grew up on, whether it's like, you know, it can be something like Husker Du, or it could be Motley Crue, or it could be Operation Ivy, or, you know, or a hell of a lot of Green Day. That's for sure. So
how hands on were you guys with the programming of the channel?
We did like, I sat down and did like a bunch of just different, you know, recording kind of call out kind of stuff with the channel. And, you know, I definitely want to invest more time into it because I love making compilations and playlists and stuff like that. So in the future, you know, I definitely want to do more where, cause like, you know, hearing, you know, the unheard music, as they say, is stuff that I, you know, that's why I love Underground Garage, because you know discovering things that aren't normally you hear every day. So that's been great.
You know, I've done these Coolest Conversation interviews for a few years now, and typically when I ask someone if they have some moment, some rock and roll epiphany, you know, some sort of event that takes place, and afterwards they knew they, you know, that their life was going to be rocking and rolling. And the most common answer is seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And that, of course, speaks to the age of a lot of the people that I wind up talking with. Although I can still be quite surprised. Like last year, I spoke with Peter Buck and I asked him that question. And he was like, oh, yes, it was the Beatles. And he was just like eight, maybe seven or eight when they were on Ed Sullivan. But, you know, that was so impactful. And I bring this up because beginning last year, I started getting a new answer consistently with the people, you know, younger, and that is you hearing Green Day, like the first time they heard you guys or saw you guys, finding out that, you know, people are inspired by hearing your music, and then they're going on to pursue their own artistry. How does that hit you?
I mean, it's great. I mean, it's, you know, I'm a music fan, you know, I love my record collection, and, you know, I love my things that I download or stream. So that's what I think I connect with when people are actually fans and they get inspired to make, you know, have their own band and things like that. So it's just great. Like people, like I, you know, it's more than I could ever ask for, is like people to actually be influenced by what we do and then do their own thing with it, you know, when, and sometimes it's things that, you know, like that don't sound like Green Day, that they, you know, but it's just kind of part of their, you know, their own evolution as a musician and stuff like that, that, you know, they, maybe they started with us and it turned into something else, you know, but it's pretty cool.
Well, did you have any kind of rock and roll epiphany or moment that you saw something or heard something, and then that was kind of, after that, you were just sort of off to the races?
Oh, man. You know, I've been playing guitar since I was 8, believe it or not. That's the first time I ever got a guitar. I don't know. I think, like, probably when I hit high school and I started going to Gilman Street, where it really kind of kicked in. You know, I think it was like going to Gilman, seeing, you know, the Replacements play the Fillmore in like 1987. And it all kind of like came together at the same time. And that's when I was like, me and Mike Dirnt like really made the switch from wanting to play like, you know, heavy metal, but, and really wanting to get into to punk and alternative, and really getting in, you know, it's like, oh man, these people are dedicated to like writing songs. You know, it's not about who plays the fastest or who plays the fastest lead guitar. And I think we just connected a lot more with that kind of music, like punk rock, and where it was just like, oh man, this is more serious and it's more kind of more fun in a way. And it wasn't like macho, and it wasn't this, you know, like glossy stuff that you would see on MTV. It was like real, you know? So I think it's probably right around there in 1987 for me.
And so when you mentioned Gilman Street, we're talking about the punk rock club there in San Francisco.
Yeah. It's in Berkeley.
I'll rephrase it, say the Bay Area.
There you go. There you go. There you go.
We're going to listen to one more song off the new album, Saviors. It's going to be Living in the 20s. And I was wondering if you're much of a Hives fan.
Oh, I love the Hives.
I was thinking Living in the 20s is the best song Randy Fitzsimmons never wrote.
That's amazing. Yeah. You know, that song is sort of about like all of the, like, it's about like sort of our collective insanity in this country when it comes to things like QAnon and conspiracy theories. And I just sort of, you know, slammed it all into like one, you know, American culture vomit or something. So it's that was a fun song to write.
Yeah. Well, Billy, thanks again for speaking to me on our Coolest Conversations and helping make our Green Day week here in the Underground Garage so special.
Awesome, man. Well, it's great to talk to you.
All right, we're going to take a listen now to Living in the 20s from Green Day and off of Saviors and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Just heard a brief portion of Green Day's Living in the 20s, and that track is on their latest album, Saviors. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Billy Joe Armstrong for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. New Jersey band The Weaklings, they've got a new album out on Gem Records. It's titled Raspberry Park, and we'll find out all about it next time around when I'm joined by band member Lefty Weakling, a.k.a. Glenn Burtnick. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Ain't that a kick in the head?
Daddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.